Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. Good morning. Welcome to Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I want to thank you for joining us. I have Betsy Rosh Gilman on the line with me also from Training for Change. She's out in Minnesota. Today we're going to be talking about Martin Luther King and his principles of nonviolence. I thought about this subject mainly because I have a daughter, and I see a lot of, to me, it seems more violence happening with young people in high schools at a younger age, either inflicted on each other or violence inflicted on them, maybe from adults, unfortunately, in their environments. And so also I thought about it because Martin Luther King's celebration of his birthday. Actually, the other day, January 15th, was his actual birthday. We here celebrated on Monday by taking Monday for a day of service. He was an amazing man, and the more I studied about him, it really made me question myself, do I have the courage to use nonviolence in my life, whether in interpersonal relationships or in conflicts that are greater out in the society in terms of injustices that I see with racism or poverty or war. We have a lot of wars going on right now, America and Iraq, Israel and Palestine, you know, human rights violations, Darfur, and then even closer to home, domestic violence. You know, every day there is a domestic violence. Every day there's probably several thousands of domestic violence acts going on around the world. Martin Luther King had basically six principles of nonviolence. I'm going to read those off to you. Nonviolence is a way of life for courageous people. Nonviolence seeks to win friendships and understanding. Nonviolence seeks to defeat injustice, not people. Nonviolence holds that suffering can educate and transform. Fifth one, nonviolence chooses love instead of hate. And nonviolence believes that the universe is on the side of justice. In studying about him, I realized that, remember, he was a minister, and he comes from that viewpoint of Christianity and turn the other cheek. And I guess a lot of people who aren't Christians may think, well, why should I feed into this as a choice for me to deal with conflicts in my life? And he used it very successfully, though. I mean, he wasn't automatically boiled over like, oh, this is going to work, when he first heard about it. He heard about it when he was at Howard University listening to a minister speak and you know, just tweaked his interest about Gandhi. He actually went to India and met some of Gandhi's relatives and was over there for about a month. And, you know, he didn't know right off the bat that this principle of Gandhi's was going to work. You know, he tried it, and the more he tried it, in my readings, his discovery is that it worked and it strengthened him and it gave him energy to go on to continue using it. I think, again, going back to the children, teenagers are very up and down and left and right, and they don't really stop to think. Betsy, do you think that this is something that we can teach children, or is it too high-minded? How can we make it digestible for teenagers to understand this concept of nonviolence?
Well, thanks, by the way, first of all, thanks for having me on your show.
Thank you.
One of the things I think that's really important to remember about the civil rights movement that Dr. King led is that so many of the people who participated were exactly young people. So many of them were college students, high school students, and in one particular crucial campaign, he enlisted grade school children. And the question of can we offer this as an alternative, yes, definitely. And I think that there are some particular things that to kind of notice about nonviolence that in talking with younger people about nonviolence or acting with them in concert, that this whole question of suffering is one that is a hard one to get around. particularly, I think, for young people, and particularly for young people who don't start out with a whole lot of privilege, that there's a question, a very natural and logical question about, well, you know, what's so great about suffering? I mean, I can...
I'm already suffering. You know, I'm already
right,
suffering.
You know, I
don't have enough clothes, or, you know, my mom is getting beat, or, you know, I'm getting bullied at school. Why do I need to try to suffer by choice? You know?
Yeah, precisely. And I remember hearing a story particularly about a march during the Democratic National Convention protests in 2000 in Los Angeles, where a large march of people went to a particular police station, one of the areas where the police had been particularly violent and brutal to demonstrators and were that way generally to the public, and a march against police brutality, and led primarily by young white activists. And as they grew closer to the police station, the young Latino activists who were in the crowd kind of dropped back and dropped to the sides and said, you know what, we can get arrested any old day of the week. We don't have
right.
To
Why choose to get arrested today?
Yeah, right, exactly.
Right, right.
So, and I think that question of suffering is really a crucial one to address. There's a difference. What I do say is that there's a difference between being a victim and the kind of suffering that Martin Luther King talked about. The kind of suffering that he talked about and that Gandhi, he was building on Gandhi's principles here, it's putting yourself right in the path of injustice, knowing that you may suffer for as a consequence in order to bring attention to that injustice and to show how bad it is.
Right, right.
So there's... That's a real critical piece to address with younger folks who are just beginning to understand this whole philosophy, this whole mechanism of creating social change.
Right. Gandhi had an interesting quote. It was from the mind of Mahatma Gandhi, and it was talking about this idea of ahimsa. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, and it's ahimsa, and I guess a very general, is dealing with like not inflicting pain. It's a Sanskrit word, and not inflicting pain on people. And he has this line that said that if the function of himsa, which is violence, is to devour all that comes across, the function of ahimsa is to rush into the mouth of himsa. So it's saying just like, well, it's an active choice. It's not a passive thing. It's not a victim mode. You know, you're making a choice, you're actively, and I think that energy, he also talks, Mahatma Gandhi, about the heat that is generated from, a spiritual or physics type of sense, the heat of ahimsa generates this passion and this drive that helps push you along in the face of violence. I think that even on a micro level in terms of interpersonal relationships, Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King talk about how the mind and the body can't be separate, and how you can't just physically, you know, walk down the road. It also has to, it's a mental process that you have to go through to prepare yourself to be in the face of that suffering.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's not for the weak. And that's why I said in the beginning, like, can I be, you know, can I stand up for nonviolence myself?
Mm-hmm.
It's not an easy choice, and that's what made me, I admire Martin Luther King and Gandhi and others like them for actively choosing that. Because a lot of people talk about nonviolence and it's great and this and that, but have they actually participated in using it in their lives or in society to solve the issues that we're dealing with now?
Mm-hmm.
In terms of teen violence, I was also reading about girls increasing violence with young women.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some people who think, well, feminism kind of spurred that, you know. And then there are other people who feel that that it's just in terms of the level of freedom people have in America, that it doesn't really happen other places in the world. But eventually, reading different articles, it's come to find out there actually seems to be, in terms of statistics, not more teen violence, but more accountability by the police in terms of arresting children or documenting the incidents that are happening between girls and young boys. What is your opinion about that, Betsy?
You know, I'm not real familiar with what you're talking about, the study that you're talking about. I think that the question about, again, it comes back to that question about self-suffering and victimization. I don't see anything, and I'm sure that King would not have seen anything redemptive or socially useful in in domestic violence. I don't see and that there's anything that he would have, and I certainly don't think that this is a good idea somehow. I think that there's two things, there's two aspects of nonviolence. One is what we've been talking about, the kind of the use of nonviolence to and kind of pursue a social agenda, actually kind of enhancing the level of conflict, bringing the level of conflict up. Instead of just sort of sitting passively by and watching something unjust occurring, using nonviolence to, say, draw attention to that injustice, perhaps even create a picture of graphic illustration of that injustice, like, you know, police beating on my head instead of somebody else's head.
Right.
That's an escalation of conflict, actually. There's another use of nonviolence, which is the de-escalation of conflict. And that I think that when you talk about teaching nonviolence in high schools and using it to defuse violent situations, that's a different usage. There's just two different ways of using it. And in the de-escalation of conflict nonviolently, what we stress in training for nonviolence is good listening skills. Letting somebody kind of express their violence, their opinion without violence,
right?
Listening them down to a level where then you can say, okay, well, I've listened to you so far, but now I have an opinion to say, saying it, and then listening to their reaction. And sometimes that takes a lot of discipline. It really takes a lot of discipline to engage in an interaction that intentionally, to know that I'm going to listen to a lot of garbage, a lot of stuff I don't really want to hear. And I'm going to listen to that until the person has kind of lost the emotional charge, and then I'm going to actually intentionally re-trigger that emotional charge with my own opinion.
Right.
And then I'm going to listen and make that commitment to listen them down again, and then re-trigger escalate with my own opinion again, and then bring it down again with active listening. And
well, that's important that you say that, because that's one of the key points, is the misunderstandings that people have. That's one of the main, I think, things that develops conflict, is because you really don't understand, or you're not interested even in some cases, understanding the other perspective. But and understanding another perspective, maybe you can develop some type of sympathy. And then maybe you actually are more similar than you realize, and you have empathy for that person. Because we're all human. I mean, we all go through so many similar, traumas in our life or injustices. And different, you know, it's just a different shape that it may come in, or a different mask.
Mm-hmm.
But injustice, or with any mask, is a negative on a person, and it scars them. And I think those scars are what people are walking around with, and they try to inflict the pain they received on others. You know, if you think about Hitler or you know, other people, and you know, with great levels of power inflicting on the little people, if you study them, you usually find out that they were brought up with a lot of pain that was inflicted on them.
People who are violent in their domestic partnerships, most often, almost entirely, were the victims of violence themselves as they were growing up. So.
Yes. And it's funny, in studying, I had a class in college on family violence, and they were talking that even children who were not actually physically violated, but they watched their parent, mother in a lot of cases, unfortunately, be violated physically or hit, verbally abused, they were still affected.
Mm-hmm.
Even though they didn't physically get hit, but they saw it, they were surrounded by it on a daily basis, that in turn, that's what they saw as love. That's what they saw as conflict resolution. Mm-hmm. So when they grow up or they go out into the world, they inflict that on others. I had an example with my daughter, actually. When she was in first grade, she was choked by a little boy in her first grade class.
Mm-hmm.
And when she came home and told me this, I thought, What, honey, what do you mean you were choked? Just, I wasn't prepared to deal with that at all. What do you mean? And I said, show me what happened. And she put her hands to my neck and grabbed my neck, and this is what the little boy did to her in the schoolyard.
Oh, wow.
And I was, like, blown away because I was prepared, I think, to deal with that type of conflict maybe if she got to high school. But first grade happened.
Yeah.
And I had to go to the school, and I had to talk to the principal, and they tried to belittle it, and I said, no, I'm not going to get a call from the school that my child was choked in the schoolyard.
No.
You know, I mean, I didn't want to hear that. So, you know, but come to find out, the little boy was in an abusive home.
Uh-huh.
And the school yard, during the lunch hour, the person that monitors the schoolyard told me she was actually concerned of telling the boy's parent because she knew that the boy's father or was going to probably discipline the boy, you know, aggressively because of it.
Mm-hmm.
And but what makes the story even more interesting is we saw the young man in the street one day, just we were walking in our neighborhood, and he was happy to see my daughter.
Hmm.
I didn't realize it was a little boy. He was a little older. And he was like, hi, how are you? And I was like, hi. And at first I didn't, you know, realize it. I just naturally said hi. And then I was walking and I was like, oh, my God, was that so-and-so? And my daughter was like, yeah. And I was like, wow, he probably liked my daughter. But this expression of violence was what he was taught or saw mm-hmm. as love.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And actually, you know, I mean, that's not. And then that was out of his power, out of his control because he was a child,
mm-hmm.
you know. So it's like love, the negative side of love, you know. But Dr. King and Gandhi were focusing on the positive aspects of love and using love to annihilate, in a sense, or to diffuse, I guess, the evils in the world.
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Dr. King, he talks about the six steps for nonviolent social change, information gathering, understanding, you know, educating yourself, what is your personal commitment
right.
to this, the negotiations, which is, I think what you were discussing is that you're going to reignite the conflict, I guess, mm-hmm. probably during the negotiation cycle
mm-hmm.
and direct action mm-hmm. and then finally reconciliation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think,
and,
yeah.
No, what were your experiences? Because you, from Training for Change, you have said that you're a trainer, you've worked with a variety of groups. What have been your experiences with people when you initially meet with them? Are they open? Are they defensive, wary? Are they people calling you, or are you going to places where you feel that you're needed?
Kind of a mixture, yes to all of that. Training for Change, mostly as an institution, mostly we respond to invitations to do trainings. And we have been doing nonviolence training since we opened on Martin Luther King Day of 1991. And the kinds of trainings that we do, nonviolence trainings, mostly are in response to a particular demonstration or a particular campaign that is for social justice in some way. Now, we have also done, and there's a growing number of people who do nonviolent intervention in active conflict. Usually this is active conflict that is someplace else in the world, but Training for Change has been part of developing an 18-day curriculum for people who are setting out to intervene as nonviolent actors in a violent situation. And
okay.
That is the most expensive training that we've put together. It's 18 solid days of.
Tell us your website. What's your website?
Oh, what's that?
What's your website address so people can go to your website?
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's www.trainingforchange.org.
Now, how did you get involved with them in this process? of nonviolence? Is it something somebody told you about, or you have been doing this for a while before you even knew about the organization?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me personally, in 1967, I stumbled across, that was the year that Israel invaded began the war against what was then Egypt-controlled Gaza Strip. And that was the year in which that war broke out, called the Six-Day War. And in the course of that Six-Day War, I stumbled across a little booklet called In Place of War, which was a small booklet that was written by a task force of the American Friends Service Committee, posing the possibility that we could have a system of conducting warfare that would be completely nonviolent, that is opposed to needing huge armies for self-defense or aggressiveness, as we were seeing at that moment in the Middle East, that we could have self-defense based on a civilian model, that we could have people trained, this could be part of all of our training, to know how to resist an occupying force. We wouldn't need a military to do that job for us. Of course, that would be combined with a major drastic change in the way that we see ourselves in the world. The United States sees itself in the world, because what we're calling defense, quote unquote, right now, very often is protecting our economic interests in other countries.
Well, what would you say? I have a friend who's over, who has been over in Iraq, I guess, for four years, and I mean, he's a good person. What would you say to this person who's a soldier? He is trained to use violence to deal with conflict.
Mm-hmm.
Is that person? But maybe in their heart, they do believe in the idea of nonviolence.
Mm-hmm.
What do you say to these young men and women who are over there fighting for what we think is our freedom? And again, I do agree with you with the aspect of the economic the economics that are being protected and people's monetary interests. I believe that's what's happening. They're being protected, not necessarily helping all of our freedom.
Mm-hmm.
But what do you say to the soldier who's over there?
I think that probably most soldiers over there are actually discovering exactly the limits to violence. And most soldiers over there, I think, actually would say that the most successful things that they are doing are things that rely on nonviolence, on establishing relationships, on getting to know the Iraqi people, getting to know their concerns, getting to know their issues, and being able to solve problems that arise without resort to arms. I think that that is actually, I mean, when we talk about the success, that the so-called success of the surge, a lot of it, of course, depends on just buying off our enemies, because we have funded groups that used to be in conflict with us, so we funded them not to be anymore.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
But,
isn't that crazy how one time we fund them, and then now we're fighting them?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
It's crazy.
But a lot of the success of the surge has depended on building relationships with the leaders, tribal leaders in Iraq, and building relationships.
I think that's what Obama and his administration hopes to do. A lot of people are very wary of him wanting to speak with different leaders from various factions.
Yeah.
But if we're going and focusing on Martin Luther King today and the issue of nonviolence, and the steps to understand, quote unquote, your enemy or your opposition, then he's right in line with that principle of trying to understand the opposition. He's using that principle of a great man, and he was successful with it. But people are so, do you think it's fear that people are afraid of him talking with these leaders? What do you see as the resistance?
I think another very basic principle of nonviolence, and I think you kind of alluded to it, of allowing room for friendship and for relationships to develop. And I think that one of the reluctance to do that is a lot based in our conviction that we are right, and somehow our rightness would be jeopardized if we talked to somebody we thought is wrong. So if we talked to the leadership of Iran, that it would be, we'd somehow jeopardize our rightness. by talking to the leadership of Iran because they're so wrong, and dividing that the world into these categories of right and wrong and good and evil, I think that that is contradictory to the principle of nonviolence, which is about developing relations, allowing the possibility for friendships, for mutual interests to be discovered and to develop.
Right. Well, Martin Luther King talks about that people are not evil, the evil situation, and that you're not trying to defeat the people, but you're defeating the injustice.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that was his focus, and I think that's why he was successful, because he kind of...
He could make that distinction.
He just took the people, he realized that, well, I think also maybe from his Christian background that maybe the idea of evil, the word evil, and that they were overtaken by evil or being used by evil for a negative purpose, mm-hmm. and that they, it was out of their control. Mm-hmm. And so he met them with the power of love, mm-hmm. and hoping that the love would, change them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I really want to thank you for coming on today. We only have a couple minutes left. I did see a couple callers and then they hung up, and I have I can see on the switchboard. But people also can listen online, so they don't show up on the switchboard necessarily, but they're still listening.
Mm-hmm.
This is Betsy Rosh Gilman. She's calling in today from Training for Change, and their website is www.trainingforchange.org. It's all together, one word.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to say again, thank you so much for coming on today's show.
Yeah, well, thanks for inviting me. Yeah.
I want to thank the callers that did call in. And please call next week. Next week we're going to be talking about African-American women and breast cancer. The American Cancer Society is going to be coming on next week along with Ronna Walker. Ronna Walker is a counselor. She was actually a counselor on the show Starting Over, which was an Emmy Award-winning show where she helped women who came to live in a house deal with their issues and advance in their life. And she's going to be coming on next week, January 24th at 11 o'clock, here on Saturday mornings with Joy Keys. I just want to close the show with a quote from Martin Luther King. This is... The aftermath of nonviolence is the creation of the beloved community. The aftermath of nonviolence is redemption. The aftermath of nonviolence is reconciliation. The aftermath of violence, however, are emptiness and bitterness. This is the thing I'm concerned about. Let us fight passionately and unrelenting for the goals of justice and peace. But let's be sure that our hands are clean in the struggle. Let us never fight with falsehood and violence and hate and malice, but always fight with love, so that when the day comes that the walls of segregation have completely crumbled in Montgomery, that we will be able to live with people as brothers and sisters. I want to thank you again for coming.
This
is Joy Keys. Thank you, Betsy, and I will talk to you soon.
Thank you. Yep.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.